Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Tucker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Narrative, my name is Paul, your host, Bale about Lost Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
G'day.
And Red Powell.
What up?
Welcome to the show. Got some great things to talk about. Misplays, screw-ups, personal accountability. You know, all the hot button issues. Talking about all, like, this is me. I did this this past weekend, so.
Yeah, I don't know anything. I don't know anything about these issues. I'm perfect.
Everybody is, you know, as far as like, you know, everybody goes in there with best intent. But before we get into that, I actually want to talk about a couple of cool things going on right now. First is a raffle put on by some great friends of the show and some folks that even have helped us kind of behind the scenes a bit in the past. They are having a raffle for a 2,000 point fully painted Tyranid army, painted by amazing painters. I mean, these are pro painters. These are, you know, YouTube painters. These are folks that just paint phenomenally good miniatures. This list actually came from the other show that we do over on the Meta Chasers, Tyranid List from Dustin Henshaw, you know, passed through me and Adam and on to them to build this army list. So it's not only just a great foundation for whatever is to come for the Tyranids, it has its roots steeped in some being able to be like playable, competitive, and good. That is pretty cool. And for the low cost of £5 per ticket, and I'll put the link in the show notes, you have the opportunity to potentially come away with this army to benefit the Mind charity. This is a mental health charity. All that stuff is very important. Please check it out if you are so inclined. If you like the look of the army, you want to give it a shot, you like the cause, you like to give it a shot, I just want to be a part of something, throw something in there for the opportunity. You know, all put together with the best intent going to a great cause, and I really want to talk about it here. The drawing is in the first week in November, so you got a few days by the time that you hear this for it to go up to see if I get a few tickets to help push them to their goal. Their goal is, I think, £5,000, and they're almost there, and we can help get them there.
Nice. Love to see it. Love to see so many people trying to do good in our community and extend that goodness beyond the bounds of just playing with our toy soldiers.
Seeing the community come together to be something, you know, like greater than like the sum of its parts and put some of this momentum towards great works, good works, helping people. Very, very nice to see. So please check it out. Look at the army. Just go look at the army. See if I'm kidding about the army. Like, just go check it out and look at that. See if I'm kidding about the army. It looks awesome. Next thing I want to talk about briefly before we get going is the Coastal Assault event. This event had its debut, well, guess when? November of 2019. This is going to be
in
Fort Walton Beach, Florida. I went to the opening events. Actually, it was put on by a great friend of mine. This is going to be put on by another friend of mine who's kind of he's kind of passed the torch to him to organize and run this thing. But it's all going to be them and the community down there helping out, which has some great folks that are like mainstays in the southeastern area of the tournament scene. And Coastal Assault, it's right there on the coast of Florida. Going down there in November, you want to escape some of the cold, the wintry touch of Atlanta and Chattanooga. You can go down to Fort Walton Beach and still wear a t-shirt or a light hoodie and be comfortable. That is December 14th and 15th, 2024. If they have a link to sign up, I will put that in the show notes as well. In 2019, I came in second at that tournament.
So nice.
100 or so players. Yeah. I was like, you know what? I can still do this. I can't wait till until January. And then you know what happened. But that was an interesting time. But I'm glad they're picking it back up again because that community is awesome. So if you can make it, check them out. Now all that other stuff I was talking about, personal accountability. So as you know, I'm really excited about the new Angels and playing list and trying to figure out a list that I like and going through that process of putting things together, brewing and playing them on the tabletop and testing. One of those units that I'm testing is Blade Guard. Had this interesting conversation. I was talking to my buddy and I was like, you know, folks on the internet are saying like, you know, maybe Blade Guard is not that great and Sanguiner is not that great. Maybe it costs too many points or whatever. He's like, aren't you on the internet too? I was like, yeah, I am on the internet. So, but at the same time, you know, you look at what's out there and then you try to make sense of it for yourself. And then, of course, you got to play what's right for you. And then you got to, you know, maybe you do have a take on it that's different than everyone else. You know, you got to play through and walk it through. And one of these ideas that I'm brewing up is Lieutenant with a Blade Guard and an Impulsor. The Lieutenant gives him lethal hits. Now, you can get lethal hits in the Blood Angels pretty easily, you know, with a couple of, with a Liberator assault force. And but I like having things as my UA take some of these characters to get something you don't have to spend command points on. I don't know how thirsty the army is for command points yet, so I'm just experimenting with this stuff. And I can, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. Just because you can get something from a resource expenditure, like, oh, why would I take your lieutenant when I have a CP for the thing that a lieutenant gives? Because now you don't have to spend that CP on that unit. You now free it up so you have, you know, Armor Contempt on tap just at all times. You now have to worry about whether you've got that, and you have inbuilt what you were going to pay for. So it kind of widens the I suppose the spectrum of things you can use a CP on. You got more CP for grenades, you got more CP for tank shock, you got more CP for heroic intervention and things like that. So it doesn't invalidate things just because you can get something somewhere else. You can look at it as just another reason to expand your play patterns.
I like the point you just made. That's kind of what I've got in the back of my head. It's like, maybe, because again, when I say the thirsty for command points, it's not just a play on the angel shtick. That is that I don't know what the burn rate of these CP are. How many am I going to need a turn to, you know, to feel like I'm playing the way that I want to play or going up against what I'm going against?
In addition to that, like, it's when you say, oh, well, I have lethals on a command point. Like, how many times are you fighting with exactly one unit a turn as a Blood Angels player? Pretty much never. So you're probably always going to have somewhere else to chuck the lethals as well.
Guaranteed. That's how these games have been working out, is multiple combats all the time, which is its own peril sometimes. But, you know, hey, it's what the army's built for. And, well, anyway, with Blade Guard, they have an ability that you can either, it's in the fight phase, you know, you pick reroll ones to hit or reroll ones on your invulnerable saves. I thought that after I chose that it lasts until the next turn. That's not the case. It is until the end of that phase. And I did not, and I'm sure I read that on the first playthrough. Like, I'm positive I read through on the first time I looked at the unit. But then immediately, I guess, you know, maybe our beverage choices had something to do with it. Maybe the fact that I had a, you know, had a busy week at work, you know, whatever, you know, caused that last little negative bit to escape, you know, out of the back of the brain. And did not rediscover that until we were at the end of the game, you know, going through the choices in the list, like, hey, you know, did this perform, did that perform, trying to do a real solid evaluation beyond what the outcome of the score of the game was, just evaluating the performance of the units effectively. And I break it out. I'm like, oh, he's like, I think he used that. No, I definitely used that. That was the time he got six wounds from a tank through. And sure enough, three passes, three ones, re-rolled them all into passes, which is not what should have happened. And look, if he's listening, I sincerely apologize for that. But I more really want to illustrate it to the fact, you know, that it was, you know, we can all make those types of mistakes. And how do you try to avoid them, you know, and then go from there?
I think it's important, before we go into this probably very interesting discussion, the number of people who walk into a game with an intention of playing incorrectly is an absolute minutia, an absolute minimum. Like, so few players. I've been playing for 10 years. I'm assuming you boys have been playing for that long or longer. Well, I know you've been playing for longer.
Nope, just 10. And young and over
spry,
here.
I can count on one hand the amount of interactions that I've had where I truly thought someone intended to play incorrectly to their advantage. It's literally happened so few times. And I love the fact that, I mean, there's a lot of times, I mean, that people play incorrectly to their disadvantage as well, that we don't talk about because we can't look at any
malice. I forgot Oath of Moment for 3.5 turns.
Yeah. That's just as incorrect I play as, you know, as what you just described with the Blade Guard. And yet we don't talk about that one, do we? We talk because that's to your detriment.
Right. Well, and so Hanlon's Razor, right? Never attribute to malice what you could more likely attribute to ignorance or stupidity.
Yeah.
right? Yep. Or laziness. And so, like, there's so many other aspects to that and, like, what plays into it and the fact that we're playing this with people and not computers who just follow the rigid rule structure. And like you said, you know, whether you're having a good time in other ways by enjoying yourself and drinking or whatever, or, some people... One of my less than desired environments, you know, I'm sure you've heard of these Ironman tournaments where it's like five games in one day kind of one deal. Day. Like, who isn't burnt out by the end of that? And then, like, you know, the competitive edge of that is just worn away to certain points because people are just exhausted. And, like, expecting everybody to play the perfect game ever is almost never and just not a thing. There's a social contract to how we play this game and being able to understand that people are going to make mistakes abroad. And then also there's the other part for everyone that's out there that's still new to play, like you said, some of us have been playing for a much longer time and we're still making all the mistakes, especially as the editions roll out and the new codexes come out. But the only way to really work through that and get better in the way of recognizing where you can do better, where you can play your rules more, correctly, as well as learning other people's rules and becoming more aware, which is a huge part of it, is to just play games. They don't have to be the most competitive games. You don't have to be, playing for pink slips and the titles or whatever, but just to play games and you work your way through that. And yet, again, that doesn't assure any of us that we aren't going to make mistakes. I can't say how many I know that I've made a multitude of mistakes across the board, and it's difficult and you hate it because, it feels sometimes like it maybe a cheap experience for the other player when you do that. You hate that, but we're all striving to have a good time. We're all striving to do better. And it's much, much, much rarer circumstance when someone's truly trying to maliciously take advantage of it just so that they can win at the game of, plastic
miniatures. I'm glad y'all brought it up because I don't want this discussion to be like some type of excuse to play sloppy or oh, my bad, did the brain explodey thing, but we still do that. Like, we still have to play this game. It's an hours long experience. And sometimes the frequency in which everyone plays, maybe wider or shorter or whatever, heck, maybe they got someone told them to play, the rule was different before the game started or something.
Yep. And Matt, having played at a couple of international events, could just be a language thing. The comma is in a different place in that in your language printing of the book. And therefore, you think it's this way, I think it's this way, and we actually don't know which is correct.
In this case, the rule about the end of the fight phase is very clear.
fair.
At least in English.
A great statement that I have found, especially in 9th edition, I started saying it's in 9th edition, and I carried it in 10th edition. It's not at a baseline level of the game, before we get to competitive juices and a winner and loser, it's not me versus you. It's me and you versus the rules in 5 turns. And it's our job that we're going to work together and make sure we have as enjoyable experience as possible, playing as tight and correctly as possible. But it's me and you. It's not you trying to bludgeon me with a rule or me trying to claim ignorance for a rule or anything like that. We've got to work together, read things together, collaborate, and try and get through 5 turns successfully.
When we're jibber-jabbering about 40K online, we talk about it's often a collaborative experience. Like, you are, you're playing against an opponent, but you are having an experience there together. And you've got to kind of get through it together. And Red, I believe in our pre-show, you brought up the fact, like kind of the some of the challenges of knowing your rules and your opponent's rules, but that's just kind of a part of the game right now.
Go ahead, Adam.
So in some ways,
that wasn't the computers didn't glitch. There wasn't a disconnection. He literally made that face like 3 times before he started talking.
So we're more than a year into 10th edition. And I believe in a lot of ways they've made 10th edition a lot easier to pick up as a game. The core rules are, in a lot of ways, much more easier to attain, understand, and conceptualize in order to get going in the game. But when you get to the event level, I think things are a little harder now than they were before. Mostly because previously you had, here's your detachments. And I'll say this, there are some absolutely, there absolutely are some exceptions in 9th edition where you had like a detachment that had six different books of stratagems compiled into one big old mess. But now that is every single data sheet has a unique, every single data sheet has a unique ability. Every single unit does something unique and different. And when, you know, just Space Marines has over 100 units, I want to call it the burden, but the knowledge that we expect from each other is pretty high when you count the things we all have to know about each other in order to play the game sometimes.
Red, I'm sorry, I'll shut up for a second.
I'll let you go now, Red. Thank you.
No, I mean, it's incredibly valid. And the, you know, it's not like chess. And I feel like we got to start with that initial kind of scene setting of this whole thing for everybody, because, you know, there are people who can, just like, I know, I'm sure there are 40K players who can go back and forth with it in their head. But, you know, being able to play chess without a board in front of you, because you understand it's a 8x8 grid and the pieces are confined to a certain point. Now, when you take it and those pieces on the other side of the board have 16 to 20 different variations of rules, and you look at the complication therein, and it's no longer an 8x8 grid, but a matter of a, you know, 44 by 60 board of inches and whatnot, like the whole thing becomes this other aspect. And you know, it's funny because the way that, and we've been to GW events, we've been to other events and whatnot, the way that terrain boards are set up now according to the gameplay and terrain layouts by GW, and what people can do with what terrain, and not everybody, not even, you know, GW even has some of the U-shaped terrain that goes into these GW layouts. And so, like, at least some of the events, right? It's just there's something to, like, how you play with what's there. But the knowledge of understanding that across the board and being able to figure out between how the board is set and what your army does and all the different variations of it, and then what also all the other 20 factions do.
And then the mission.
And then, yeah, don't. You know, you knew Leviathan. Congratulations. Have you read Pariah's Tournament Companion? Have you, you know, hey, the FAQ in Errata is 35 pages long. I hope you have picked up all of that on top of the rule book. I mean, the rule book, you're right. Like, it is barrier to entry up front in the regards of rules. The rule book's at least 4 to 6 pages, maybe. Just like, hey, here it is. Like, here's the phases. The app does make things a lot very convenient. You know, as someone who just TO'd this last weekend of an event, it is something where I do put the onus on the individual as a judge that, like, hey, you should have your rules and you should have referenced them. You should have pulled it up and read it. There's nothing wrong. Like, I'm pretty confident I know the answer to the question that someone just asked me as a judge. And yet I'm still going to walk up and say, OK, who's got the rule? Where is it? Mm. Have you read it? Okay. And you still have so we've still got a question. You just read the rule right in front of you. Totally. That's good. That's what judges are there for, to help make rulings, right? We're not, you don't need me for rules. We've got an app that actually pulls all that stuff up. We've got, I mean, everyone's got a smartphone nowadays. I mean, it's not like it's impossible.
You can type the word into the app and the reference section will bring it up.
It will. Now, you got to be very specific in some cases. Some of the words are a little particular, but, like, you definitely can type it up. And so there is some, you know, but I will say, you know, it is in the Warhammer community page. There's a downloads page where you can pull down all of the things, and they've made it, you know, it looked good previously in regards of, like, you used to be able to, like, flip through the symbols and, like, pick stuff. And they've moved to a more efficient user interface where it's literally just a list and you can just click it. You can read it and say, hey, that's what I want. I don't need to know about this. Like, I get it. Symbols or whatever. Like, I can just hit it and go. But the rulings, I mean, we got to this point. I appreciate the players and attendees of the events, but we got to this point where they were asking me, like, hey, you know, we're working on this point where we can't decide between the two of us on this thing. Like, what's the ruling on that? And that was kind of like the ability to come in as a judge and make that call or something like that, versus just having to remind people what is in the rule book. And that's a whole other thing. And there's a player base and experience level to that. You know, it's one thing when you're learning to play the game. It's another thing when you're at when you're playing into a competitive event or something and you're asking certain questions. So
I'm glad you brought up the kind of the differences, or at least mentioning and acknowledging the difference between a pickup game or a test game,
yep,
and a tournament game, because I believe that, you know, once you come to those organized play events, the expectation of your opponents is that you at least know your own rules, and there's ways to at least get close to having that be a reality, you know, either repetition through reading or playing or whatever, acquiring somehow, you know, steeping yourself in that knowledge. And, you know, so again, no excuse for not knowing it, just kind of pointing out the fact that, like, there's a lot going on in this game right now, and sometimes these minor things really, really matter. And there's, like, sometimes we joke, you know, and this is not true, but, you know, we'll read a rule that may be three or four sentences long, and we'll read two of the four sentences and be like, yep, I got the gist, and then get on with our lives.
Exactly what's going on. Yeah, I have been guilty of such a thing. Well,
sometimes it's like those little puzzles where, like, all the letters are cut out, you know, it's just certain letters. And you're like, yeah, I know exactly what that says. And so you read, you know, here's the new FAQ errata. Okay, my brain is stuck. Hopefully, if you're not colorblind, you're trying to sit there and look at the FAQ and find all the red words. And I want to then, I think I know what that just said. And then, like, but there's a point where if you don't play a game or something and those things don't come up, you may not, like, it may be much further down the road where it's like, oh, that's actually how that's supposed to be. Yeah, like the other people who've already worked through that and you're just now getting a game in or something like that can make it that much more difficult for sure.
This is a long way of saying that the Blade Guard are good. They're just not quite as good as I played them that game.
I think Blade Guard are fine. I think Blade Guard are quite good. And for the reasons that I think you've identified, they are a self-contained piece. They have rerolls on tap if they are attacking something that isn't the Oath of Moment target. You can put a variety of different characters in them to make them a bit of a Swiss Army knife. And they're durable in a way that doesn't require Armor Contempt very often. Like if you're getting shot by AP3, Armor Contempt is still a 4-up. So it doesn't matter, still got a 4-up. So I do like them because they're a thing that does the thing without needing other resources. Just strap your character of choice with them, and I think they're perfectly viable. I'm actually considering, like, at the moment, I've been tossing around playing some Ultramarines, considering Ultramarines, and Marnius Kalgar and his Victrix Guard with 6 Blade Guard actually seems pretty saucy right now.
Holding that center, you know, can be very important.
Yeah. In addition to that, the real ones to hit that they can give themselves, well, Marnius would get that too. So he's hitting on 2s re-rolling, baby, with those big old fisticuffs and McCrag. Good times.
That is pretty good. That does sound good.
And he gives them advance in charge, fall back in charge, all that nonsense. It's fantastic.
You picked all this up just because you were playing Space Marine 2 or what?
No. Yes.
They are 3-wound models also.
They are. Yeah. Three-wound Marines with a 4-up invuln.
Bucket load of attacks. Of course, even more if they're angels. And so, yeah, I have enjoyed using them. I really have enjoyed using them. So I'm probably going to keep working them and try to work them into a list and see how it works out for a few more games.
I guess one of the only kind of criticisms you can possibly throw at the Space Marines, you kind of get the best of everything, is that they're merely so outside of, like, you know, Templars and Blood Angels, Dark Angels, the Space Wolves, you have to go kind of into one of those sub factions to get a premium melee unit. Thunderwolves, Sword Brethren, Deathwing Knights, Sangard, Inner Circle Companions. None of them are in the vanilla spectrum. And so I think Blade Guard's the best of the bunch within that. So yeah, definitely I think Blade Guard are the best of what you can get if you're not playing one of those sub factions.
Now, everything I've talked about investing in them, you know, the fact that they are 180 points and you got a lieutenant or so you got some character, let's call it a character. So you've got that extra bit there of, you know, some points, and then the impulser, you know, it's like, that's a lot of stuff in there. So you're not quite sure. I have enjoyed having the transport. It's been pretty good. And have enjoyed having the character. So it seems like it's working out, but we shall see more to come on that. Also kind of experimenting between a 10 assault intercessor or 2 5s, like, you know, obviously I think having more footprint or more places to go and do things on the table really great in this mission set, but there's something really nice about rolling just what is like 2 handfuls of dice.
I have a mate who swears by his unit of 10 jump back intercessors. He says they're the bee's knees, but he's been taking them in I can't remember if it's a Stormlance detachment, and he puts a captain in there, and the captain does a bunch of mortals on the charge, and the unit does mortals on the charge, and they have grenade as well. And yeah, he's been doing hilarious things with that. Just kind of like, essentially just like throwing grenades and running into you and killing Primarchs and stuff.
Without even swinging a chainsword. Just
I'm not even rolling my attacks, mate. You're just already dead.
That's crazy. I have not done that yet. Oh, so I've been running the foot intercessors in tens,
and
the jumps in fives, but playing with those numbers a bit. But I think the new list I'm going to try next has broken up the 10 assault intercessors on foot into a bunch of fives. And, you know, because sometimes you just need somebody to go over there and stand in the corner or hug a table edge or something.
I love that terminology. hey, you, super soldier, possibly hundreds of years old, get in the corner.
Yeah.
Get over there.
You know what you did.
Go on.
Yeah, get those points.
I mean, sometimes the army's going to army. So.
Yeah. So, Red, the funniest time was... it's investigate signals, right? Was the... I know it wasn't... Yeah, when you went into the corners, you had to be within 9 inches of the corner to get the points. And just seeing Will did his players do it with their ravenous, bloodthirsty behemoths. Just like, I wonder what the general said to get them to like turn around and go in the opposite direction to push a button. I love it.
So you got to think it was like a swirling mosh pit. They just got out. They just made their way out there and then
spiral.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick break. We will come back, talk about some more Warhammer goodness. See you all in a second, everybody.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Back. Thank you for joining us, checking out our sponsors. Don't forget to hit that like, share, and subscribe. All the stuff you're supposed to hit, maybe buy a t-shirt, maybe check out Patreon. You know, look, we do this. We love doing it. Going to keep doing it. That type of engagement with the show helps kind of trick the algorithm to maybe have other people come join us and listen to what we're doing and, you know, maybe hang out with us at events every now and then. We are back, though. So on this segment, we're going to talk about, well, I'm not exactly sure. Red gave us a little bit of a teaser, but we'll let him explain it here in a second. And then some batch painting stuff. Like, we're all kind of like working on some models and talk about ways to maybe get some of those big blocks of models on the table as quick as possible. We'll end the show with that.
That's good, because I need those tips too. I'm sure there's plenty of folks out there that are leaning into whatever projects as we head to whatever events, and I'm personally still preparing large blocks of prime models for the grand narrative, so I'll take all the tips on that. But before we get to that, so the word or phrase is coup d'etat, right? It's like when you see coup, C-O-U-P, it's a French word. It means a glimpse, right? So like coup d'etat is this like shortened kind of execution thing, right? Coup d'etat is about a glimpse that encompasses a comprehensive view and what it is applied to in a lot of cases. There's this guy, Dead Carl, military theorist, strategist from, you know, relative Napoleon era, who called this military... It's the concept of military.
Did you call him
genius.
Dead Carl?
Yep, Dead Carl. Carl
is
Crosswind.
That because he is expired? Because that was 200 years ago, or was he called that at the time?
No, was he called that when he was alive?
Yeah,
he was not called that at the time.
Sup, Dead Carl? How you doing? I'm all right, mate.
I felt the need to ask because
I do too.
Okay,
someone out there is going to know exactly who I'm talking about. But so with this, when he talks about this military genius and this concept of being able to look at something in a glimpse and again come to this understanding of what you've seen in a much more comprehensive way. And so, you know, we were talking earlier in the first half about knowing your rules, knowing the game, and being able to see things and understand it. And there's something too that whether it's you're playing this war game or there's different parts or things in a profession or a life where you can walk up to something and you can see something in just a glimpse, but you can, you know, it all kind of, you understand the circumstances that go into what is there. What's
present.
Are
you just describing something like you're able to observe something very complex, but maybe like a backstory or situations that occurred to that, but you're able to kind of like instantly get it?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes, exactly. Right. So like, go ahead.
Is it like gleaning maximum insight from minimum perspective?
To a point, yes. And again, okay. Like with the whole inward eye or military genius piece that Dead Carl brings up, like take it for, I think.
I don't know if I feel comfortable calling him Dead Carl.
That's fine. Clausewitz is what a lot of other people call him. It's fine.
Dead Clausewitz.
Yeah. So, you know, what for you two specifically, and you know, the time that y'all take with what you've done as shoutcasting for 40K, you only get to see the game so often, right? I mean, y'all are off to the side. You get a glimpse of it or something like that. And for anybody that just walks up to a table or something, to be able to look at it and then to be able to see, oh, well, this is how we got here and this is where this is going. And the conclusion of this is going to go like this, right? Now, there's all sorts of things, and that's the great thing about 40K and a lot of these war games in general, is that it introduces friction through probability in regards of dice rolling, where in real life, friction occurs because something breaks, because whatever, because, you know, human error and failure and all sorts of other things that occur in real military effort. And so when you're playing these war games, like rolling a one or, failing a bunch of saves or something like that, or making a bunch of saves, you know, that's opportunity versus, dire friction or something like that. But so you can have a gut feeling of where this is going to go, and your how many times you've played it, the understanding of the rules and the environment of how things are going to go, you can come to a understanding of where things are going. Now, that doesn't mean you're always going to be correct 100% of the time, because again, friction still exists. The probability of the matter, you know, who is to say that someone isn't going to go into it and roll all sixes the entire time? It's incredibly unlikely, but could it happen? It could, and that just
not if they're playing me. I feel like that.
Well, and so, but to this point, the ability to walk up to something, just see it very quickly, and then be able to see through to the end of it, right? See where it's all going, and make a decision based off of that. That's what this Coudé is kind of where it's going, right? And so, I think that it was something that, as I was thinking about the rules and what we were talking about before, and understanding things and being able to understand the game set, and as we get and we see all these competitive events and the world championships coming up, you know, there's something to a lot of these players that are very competitive, and very well understood in how they're going to go about it. And it's always fun. I've always enjoyed it when I'm playing with someone who's like, in a lot of ways, you know, hey, just, you can do whatever. Like, it's not going to change anything I do, really. Like, I know where I'm going to go with this, and you're going to do your thing, but like, I'm just going to do whatever. And there's a glimpse of the glimpse in that kind of deal, where someone maybe they think they can see through it like that. You know what I mean?
So an example would be one player has a redeploy, one player doesn't. And so when I've had that with like Lord Solar in my guard list, I've just been like, dude, you can just leave the chest clock on me. I deploy pretty much the same every time. And then I see a little bit of your deployment before we roll off. And then I move around two or three pieces. And so I just like chuck it down, get a glance at what they're planning to do, readjust 2-3, off we go. Is that the kind of an example you?
That's like the foot in the door of the concept, right? Yeah. Because like you already, for that one scenario, you kind of already get how it's going to go. And then as you get into the game, like, hey, okay, we're gonna we're both playing tactical. We're gonna draw cards, but like I've got my general idea of where this is going to go, and I know what I'm playing against, because you know. Paul, you're Blood Angels, and I know you're going to move fast and you're going to hit it like this and this kind of piece, but I can cut to the heart of this and say, well, I think that the most critical point or the critical moment is going to be when we meet, which is likely going to be right here. And if I don't do this, and I'm not going to just throw it or what have you, because again, as we talked about before, there's something of a social contract to this, and I want you to enjoy the game too, just as much as I want to enjoy the game. But I know that at this moment, you know, turn three, we'll say, I predict we're going to hit in our most critical melee round at that point. If I come out of that and I can weather and endure it, I'm going to be able to continue to score the tacticals that I know I'm going to keep drawing, and I know I'm going to make it. So all I've got to do is do what I can to support up to that moment where I know I'm going to survive melee with Paul in round three, and that's it. That's the conclusion. And that's something that I think players get to.
Is the concept you're describing is something that people can strive to, like their exercises 100%. That they can try to familiarize themselves with? with or do or plan out to try to make that those glimpses more frequent for them?
So I think so. I think that it is something that – so there's something that people will talk about, nurture versus nature, right? And I think that there is inherent talent. There is inherent capability. People do come to the table with different strengths and weaknesses that can incline themselves towards it. Can you train it? 100%. Can you train it in a broader depth? I totally think so. There is something to practicing, right? Like Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, you know, some of these other athletes, for example, it wasn't just because they were naturally amazing that they were able to do it. They'll both attest to the fact that there was a ridiculous amount of practice that went into it of matching that inherent talent and the drive that they had and you know, the mindset. It wasn't just the skill that they had, but the mindset that then pushed them into this ability with through practice, right? The practice was the journey that got them to the point. Well, go ahead.
Just the same as what you're saying. The other extent of that is that, yes, you can train these things, but yes, like history for all of time has told us that there are people with tactical knots, people with tactical acumen that will, you know, Sun Tzu, you know, Hannibal Barca, the great amazing generals of all time and things. You know, there are people who are born and made, and people who, you know, the crucible of training, you know, and usually it's a combination of the two, right?
Yeah, like, yeah. Even those greats that we're talking about, we're not present for their 10,000 hours, you know.
Sure. I could put in the same amount of hours Michael Jordan put into training basketball. I ain't going to be Michael Jordan.
No doubt. I'm not going to tell you any differently.
At the same time, I'm going to be a much better version of myself at playing basketball.
Sure.
So you can look at it like that. I have this thing that I do in games, and I kind of it depends how much I care about or what result I'm trying to get. But I have a lot of gears when I play 40K now, mostly because if I'm not playing for a national team or an international or something, or I don't have any prospects, I like to gear down and just have a good freaking time. Still trying to win, but just the best freaking time possible. And if that means I lose because I didn't play absolute knife edge to the best of my ability, I don't really care because, you know, there's no playing for the term.
And you're talking
Australia
about you'll
is,
do things like you'll do things for the fun, like, oh, if I hit this long bomb charge,
yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or
I could just deep strike this unit onto this objective and get some points, or I could go for the 9-inch charge and you know, I'll just go yeet the charge. Might mean I get 5 less points and who knows, might cost me the game. But if it means me and my opponent have a better game, so be it. But one of the things I always used to do, and I do on and off now, is after deployment, I walk around the table. And I look at all my opponent's armies. I look at all their models, their miniatures. I do a bit of a threat assessment in my head. And I look at the terrain and I try and picture in my brain where my models have to be and what has to be dead from their army for me to win by 1 point. What I believe the end state of turn 5 has to look like for me to be in a winning position. Like, therefore, this unit must be dead or managed. These units of mine must be alive. Like, this percentage of my army of these scoring ability units must be alive. And I must be in these places on the board in order. And this is usually after we see you guys turn 1 and turn 2. And then I started doing that at the midpoint of the game. When we went down to 5 turns, I started doing it at turn 3 as well. I would do the same thing because I found that the win window of the game, it's a tongue twister, is the turn 3 to turn 4 is the win window of the vast majority of games will be decided between turn two and turn 4. Turn 1, staging, very little happens on a lot of, especially the terrain maps that we use. And turn 5, a lot of time one person's out of position or has lost enough assets, they no longer can test the field. So
and then you tell like the bottom turn scoring, like there's a lot of things you can add up. You know,
right, so the middle of the 3 turn win window, I would do another lap around the table and see how I'm doing and readjust. Is that any way linked to what you're talking about?
To an extent. Absolutely. Like there's a process that we've got and how we look at problem sets and to the point of today, like 100%, because once you've trained the process, you have a process that allows you to get there. Once you've trained that, you've developed this decision-making process and how you go about things and what you look at. And once you do that, and you practice it, just keep practicing that. It allows you to make those decisions, arguably. And of course, there's all sorts of human factors that may disagree with this or throw what I'm saying out of whack. But in a large part, in my professional understanding, as I've trained the same in similar ways of different aspects of my profession to what you're describing, we train a decision-making process. And then the more you do it and you come into these circumstances, the more you've seen, right? Because sometimes when you're playing on the same terrain, like that's the whole, I think, a huge benefit of having standardized layouts, terrain layouts, because the terrain is the terrain. Yes, there are 8 variants of it, but you've played on them and you've studied them and you understand the armies. And so that plays into your decision-making process. And the more you've done it, the less times you really need to ponder all the alternatives, because again, it's still a closed game. It only goes so many ways, right? And so as you add that up, it shortens that distance and you come to this ability to make these decisions faster, which is huge, because as you've done it and you're able to make decisions faster, it brings you into this process where if you're making decisions faster than the opponent, in some cases, now, of course, we're bound to our turns, right? So you can't just seize the initiative without them having some say-so, which is a good part.
I don't know, man. Reducing that processing power, time in your brain has a huge impact over the life of the event. Or
massive.
I mean, I shorten that time.
Yeah, 100%. And so that's where, like, again, practice and building up into it. But having a process, understanding your process, that's a whole thing leading up into it to get to this point. Some people may naturally get there faster, but practice and effort on the individual will help get to this point. Like, it is I do think that it is an achievable thing for many. I do think sometimes, unfortunately, there are circumstances that hold some back from it. And so, you know, I hate that, but at the same time, it is a thing. But, you know, the army, we've got this, the first part I want to say is we call it the intelligence preparation of the battlefield. And that's where you start with two things. You start with the enemy and the terrain. You start, the first step is the terrain. Look, because the terrain is the terrain, right? You look at Thermopylae and the Hot Gates, like that was it. They had this small little approach avenue, and then you had a little goat path off to the side, and all of Persia had to come through that point. So all you had to do was hold up to this point. You knew, like, that was the terrain that the Spartans faced, right? When you play layout 8, you understand that's what layout 8 is like, right? And so you understand how the terrain is set up.
Where the line of sight is, where the choke points, the staging areas.
That's right, 100%. How you know how the different deployment zones will play into layout 8. And so you're, okay, well, if I have this kind of deployment zone, then I need to lean here with my units here versus that or versus what. Now, again, that's understanding the terrain. And then understanding the enemy, as we've talked about, understanding the rules of your enemy, what they're capable of, what their threat ranges are, what the you know, we've joked about the terms and conditions. What are all these little things that are going to play into it? So I need to do that. So that's IPB, huge process that requires staffs of people in the military to execute in so many different ways. And all of that, what we call mission analysis, right, is this big process up front. IPB is part of that process and allows you to understand everything you have going on as you go into, like, what your courses of action are going to be. And so as you lay this whole thing out, like, that's part of the decision-making process, right? And you have to do that. So you're already, you know, Adam, in the war game, you're already doing that by looking at the terrain, looking at your enemy and how you're going to do it. The next part, and some of these, what one of my favorite little, you know, tactical discussions is about what we call the decisive point. You talked about it, you know, you said, hey, I think this is where in turn 3 or 4, we hit the decisive point. The decisive point in many tactical environments is where if you can achieve your decisive point, you essentially have the momentum to carry through and execute the rest of the game or the rest of the tactical exercise, right? Yeah. And so in execution, and sometimes, you know, we've seen it happen in different parts. You know, Paul, you know, with Blood Angels and the speed at which they can hit things, your decisive point may be, hey, I'm going to overwhelm and I'm going to penetrate the kind of their defensive line at this point, and I'm going to overwhelm them in turn 2. Just because I know I can hit it so much that if I can do this and they lose this, there's no coming back from it.
And I've identified that. You can kind of expand on that. I know if that doesn't happen, then I'm in trouble. Like, I've got to have to reevaluate, kind of thing. The plan is hinged upon, kind of thing.
100%. So this was my main effort. Here's my supporting effort that's going to either set up the main effort, right? So, like, you know, we've talked about alpha strikes, we've talked about beta strikes, we've talked about alpha charges and secondary charges and that kind of deal. So I'm going to hit this, and then if they don't do it or they don't set the conditions right, what do I have following behind it to set those conditions? So what are the conditions that I'm looking for to make that point where I've overwhelmed the tactical exercise to such an extent that I'm just going to carry it from there. Now, like, that doesn't mean you can just quit and just let it go. One of my biggest things in a lot of tactical points is follow through. That's kind of like one of my personal you know, things that I like to focus on, because in so many cases in real life, follow through becomes difficult, because follow through usually leads to a transition. Like, imagine if you had to like play battle round one and then play into battle round two and then play into battle round three with no like break. You just had to like there's no reset of like, okay, well, I'm gonna pick up all my dead stuff or whatever and just go put it back on the table. Like, that's a whole other process. But fortunately, in our closed and limited games, in which we play 40K in the war game, like, you can just focus on these iterative episodes, right? Of like, okay, well, I'm going to do this. And that's the cool thing about the war game and the tactical scenario of how you, okay, I'm going to reduce my decision-making process through practice, having a process, understanding how I'm going to get there. And then I'm going to identify the decisive point. And I'm going to do what I can to build up to that point. And I'm going to have contingencies in my plan. If I fail to achieve it here, how do I back myself up and get to that? And the only way you're going to do that, because of you understand the terrain and the enemy, is through practice.
When you were first describing this, it made me instantly think of, do y'all remember the original, well, I shouldn't say the original, but the Sherlock with Robert Downey Jr.?
Sure.
It's an old movie at this point.
Unfortunately, it is, but yeah.
When he gets like in these bare knuckle boxing matches,
oh yeah,
he plays out like how the future is going to go and then executes, see this happen in his brain, and then you see it happen like in the blink of an eye.
But the crucial point, and I got to give it to Adam really, is that a lot of people build it step by step. Okay, I'm going to start here, and I'm going to go here, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this. And what I have always lent towards, incredibly important, is actually start at the end. I want to end here. And from this point, how do I walk it back from there? And that's such a huge difference in the process. And it's really difficult. It can be really difficult for people, because if you can't see all the steps in between there, you just lose yourself in it. It doesn't seem feasible or possible. But if you can say, okay, well, I'm going to see myself at the, and if you've got to break it up in pieces, where am I going to see myself in turn three versus turn five? That it's massive. And, Paul, you highlight a great point, like the Sherlock Holmes thing. Exactly. 100%. Okay, I'm going to do this. And like, this person is going to be knocked out. They're going to be knocked out because I did this. And then what led to me getting there was this. And what led to me getting there was this, 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 and this. And then, the movie did a great job of laying that out. And because he starts with, well, first I'm going to spit in the guy's face or throw the handkerchief at him or something like that. Right. And, I mean, great little replay of that.
I mean, so, it's a movie. I'm just saying, but that's what I thought about as soon as you started.
But it's a great visual representation of it. And it happens regularly on the table, whether people want to, see it or visualize it the same way or not.
Nice. I'm just putting this topic down for a moment.
Like, good.
We don't have enough name. This is a tangent maybe we can muse on. We don't have enough names for our own stuff in 40K or in tabletop.
You know, I call stuff all the time.
But, names for moves. We don't have names for tactical this and that or plays or combinations of units. We really, really take from so many other nerddoms and or real life things. I reckon it's time for some self-determination.
The flying V.
I'm gonna coin one right now. yeah, exactly. The flying V. You're Sangard. You're flying V.
So you practice. He's a Gleeper.
The pangolin. The pangolin's a little armored anteater.
Yeah.
When you have like,
is that in Australia?
no, it's African, I believe. Might be South American. But they're scaled like an armadillo, and they eat ants, and they got a big long tongue, and they're pretty tough and sturdy for something that just eats ants. And what this is, a pangolin, is when you have your cheapest scoring unit inside a metal box, like inside a transport. So it's literally, pangolin's just full of ants, right? Because it just eats ants. So you got your chimera with just your cheapest catachans in it. That's a pangolin play. I just coined that there. It's my stamp of approval. I expect 2 to 3 cents in in copyright. But nah, let's do it.
You got to get it to take off, and then you can charge royalties once it starts.
It's already gone to the stratosphere. I've gone viral.
Oh,
you did. I don't know if you noticed. But,
okay. <yeah. laughs>
But no, I love this idea. Let's have more. Let's have more freaking catchphrases, more words that are just ours.
Yeah, maneuvers.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, so that great discussion, and thanks for bringing it up, Red. I appreciated that. And yes, we'll
that was brilliant. Yeah,
labeled and branded maneuvers. That's next week's segment.
Mm. Like bringing the two together.
Going to teach y'all the Murph.
Yeah.
For next week. But for bash painting, so I actually do have some tips for bash painting. I said just painted a bunch of Castrican recently, and you know, when you are trying to, typically I think when you're trying to batch paint, you're probably painting for some, either just to get them off your plate, you know, like I painted at one point in time 60 Gretchen, you know, all at the same time.
But I mean, that's it's not too bad.
Turn it into, well, they're small, right? It's like painting 30 regular models, I guess. No, I'm
and sure. They're like 80-85% grain.
Yeah. And that's the thing. If you're painting like something that is all flesh, you know, like what do you paint first? Like, how do you organize your steps to get through that quickly and efficiently? And then what are your goals? Like, is your goal to have, you know, 30 Golden Demon level models? Probably don't batch paint them. That's probably not for you. You know, if you're trying to get 30 battle ready models, or you're trying to match a color scheme that your army currently has or whatever, or you're trying to bust them all out in a certain amount of time. Like, what is the theory of constraints comes into effect here. Like, what are your constraints that you're trying to meet during this batch paint process?
And so I'll tell you where I'm at, and the reason I've brought this to the fore. So I've just finished painting a couple of weeks ago. I finished painting 15 Tempest of Scions, kind of in one batch, and it dang near killed me. Mostly the gold trim, because I'm painting the box art version. So it's the turquoise, also the Thunderhawk blue.
Yeah,
base.
It's a nice one.
For the army, and then the khaki, and then you shade it with reconciliation. I'm following Duncan's stuff, but using an airbrush where I can for the base coats. And man, doing the Balthazar gold trim, I was just thinking, like, I didn't sign up to paint Black Legion. I didn't sign up to do this much gold trim on 15 dudes, and it's breaking me.
They die so the toughness three models. They're barely going to spend any time on the
exactly.
table.
Exactly.
As soon as
exactly.
you put them on the table, they're going to go right back in your box. What are you doing?
Yeah, and I've got another 15 built and undercoated, ready to go, and I'm stalling out hard on starting them, because the last one was so hard a steak to chew.
That's interesting. So when you're trying to, if time is your constraint, what I like to do is do my best to get up all the layers on before I put any of the washes on. And that for I'll tell you why I struggle with that, because some colors are to me, they look like utter garbage until you put that wash on them. I mean, it is just like utter trash in my mind. Anyway, I feel like I'm not happy with this looks. I know it's going to look amazing as soon as I slap that wash on it. How do I get to the stage where I put the wash on there as soon as possible? But washes take longer to dry, you know, especially with the volume that I apply them in these situations that we're talking about. They take a little while to dry. So, you know, that probably has to be the last step you do during your painting session. It's going to add another day, another increment, more days, you know. So if that's going to delay you even more, I like to do that to be the last thing I can do. So I find that mentally organizing myself and what I need to do almost as important as organizing the colors that I want to use and the order in which I apply them. Because every time you have to like go back and fix something or whatever, which mistakes are going to happen, you're going to tidy up, you know, is what they say in the tutorials. You're going to have to tidy up your paints. But if you do them in such a way, you know, paint sometimes from like back to front, like the deepest color on the model first.
I was about to say the same thing.
Building up from there, you know, maybe you reduce the tidy up portion, you know, the phase of the painting.
Well, sorry, Red, tell us about that. What's the theory behind starting? I mean, I'm pretty sure I know it, but for people at home, what's the theory behind starting dark and working light, or that methodology?
No, I'm with what Paul was just saying as far as like, what's the deepest thing, right? Like, okay, you know, for example, I was just doing Sisters of Battle, because I've got some Sisters of Battle in my Agents of the Imperium list. And so I've got 10 of them. So this is a massive batch, but I did all 10 at once. And I kind of, I primed them all in Gracier. And then I had to look at it to say, like, okay, where can I work on, like, what's the deepest thing that's most inside, where if I do that the first time, like, it's not going to go anywhere. Like, I can afford to just build on top of it after that. Right. So I think, Paul, that's what you're talking about.
It is.
So,
yeah, like,
with my Sisters of Battle, it was, you know, the robes of their they have robes on top of or under their armor in certain cases, and between their legs and everything like that. And I went through and I'm painting them. It's the Order of the Bloody Rose, and so it's red armor, black robes, but the underrobes are tan. So I went for the underrobes first, and I started that in between their legs, and then I started, and then I did the red armor, because a lot of that's under there as well, and then I started to do the black robes, and then on top of that was the gold trim and whatnot that I had, and then I had some white, so I had to go back with my Gracier paint pot, kind of tidy up on where I was going to keep the white at, and some of it I had to go back and... It's the repairs for, because if I got red or black on any of that tan that I started with, which for the most part, it wasn't too bad because I'd started so deep and I was just working off of that. So I didn't find my brush having to get into those recesses very much beyond after that. It was just a little bit that I had to clean up after that. So it made it in the batching process because I do all the tan first and then I move to all the red of all 10 models. And then to your point, Paul, you know, after I got all that gold and then the white trim and everything, I went and put a little bit of, can't remember which orange I used, but that's what I used for the visors. And then I followed up with a Thonian camo shade on the entire model.
One of my favorites.
Well, and I tested out, you know, I had navy breachers. I tested between Nuln Oil, Agrax Earth Shade, and a Thonian camo shade. I think I always try those three just to see, like, kind of where. And
it is the Holy Trinity. You can add Gilliman Flesh to that as the bonus plus one.
Yeah, well, and I've also, you know, my brother introduced me to using Basilicatum Gray, the contrast over metal. That one does really well. And so just kind of playing around with those. Athonian camo shade, I'll be honest, tends to win out for me probably 3 out of 4, 2 out of 3 times. Like it just goes the right direction of what I'm looking for the models before I start to do any highlighting or detailing. But that I've just based the model. And by base, I mean, I did all the base paint colors on it across the batch. And then I can just essentially, it's not as bad as dipping necessarily. I'm not saying that's bad. It's just, you know, but I do take a pretty heavy amount of Athonian camo shade, get it on each model. And
that's typically in this process, the volume of wash, and that's why, you know, it's like, that's going to eat up a lot of your time if you've got that. Yep.
Well, I've started dodging. So I used to always just do an all over wash, and I've found, I do just the Games Workshop suggestion where you do an oil of wash, go back in and reestablish your base paints. And I found that going back and redoing base paints was the biggest amount of time I could cut apart from using an airbrush for base paints in the first place. And so I started taking a little bit more time with shading by doing like recess shading or panel lining or doing multiple very thin down washes. Like you do an all over, like even a 50-50 or 1/3, 2/3 lamy and medium or other thinner. So you get a very, very loose wash all over. And then you do a specific wash, like just over metallics, you know, stuff like that. And I found that saves me a lot of time. But still, how do you, so a Thonian camo shade is, I have a love hate relationship with because it stains very hard.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're not after, how do you guys manage that stain level? Because that's the one I find hard to take with a Thonian camo shade.
I
love the color.
For ghouls and Nurgle stuff. It's a green brown, for anybody that's not familiar with it, it's a green brown wash. And it's awesome. It does, it works on the same level as Nuln Oil and Agrax. But I use it for stuff that is more, a little bit more organic or potentially slimy stuff.
So I like it because I do the grim dark aspect. And this is nothing against anybody that does some of the brighter paint schemes or the more vibrant paint schemes. I think they look amazing. Way better paint jobs than anything I'll ever be able to do in a lot of cases. I'm sure if I practiced, you know, I could work up to a certain point, but I see some people do some amazing stuff with vibrant colors, but I'm not a huge fan of vibrant colors myself.
I'm the same.
I do like a more grim, dark approach, and there is something to what a Thonian camo shade does when I'm not saying I just glob it on there, but putting a weight of Athonian camo shade, it not only does it sink into the recesses like most shades do, but it also like it has a very distinct grim dark weight to it. Like I feel like my character is about to step into the game of Darktide or something. You know, well, there's almost nice. Space Marine 2. There's almost too much sunlight for me sometimes. I kind of like the darkness of the, you know, grim, you know, dark tide and whatnot.
Of his
That's possibly an interesting, and maybe this is the next hobby segment we'll do next week, but using washes for texture, like to add texture, I think is a very important thing, especially to cloth and skin. Where you want your skin to be, I want this guy to look like he's weathered and he's been on this battlefield for in this trench for like a couple of days. He hasn't got a clean face. You've seen a picture from anybody of World War One. There's ain't one like clean inch of skin on their body. They are matted and disheveled and weary. And yeah, I think you can do a lot of that with glosses, washes.
My death company that I'm painting right now, the Primaris death company, going to have it on Primaris soon, but I put unhelmeted heads on their bodies. And I know some folk that like half of the audience just cried out, you know, as if they'd been silenced. because no helmets on Marines. And I agree. I actually would like the helmeted, you know, Marines. And then, cause you're going into battle, put your helmet on kind of thing.
Of all the Marines that it makes sense for, I think only Space Wolves and Death Company can justify not having a helmet.
It's all black armor. I wanted another area of interest on the model that might help them stand out a bit, because I'm not the best at painting or highlighting black. And I plan to put some of that stuff, those techniques that you're kind of describing on the heads, if I can do it convincingly.
And plus, they were like, I'm is that Horace? I had to take his helmet off to check if it was Horace. He's like, it is Horace.
One of your close one looking right in his primary eyes.
And the Space Wolves spend so much time oiling and lathering their beards and fetishes that they think it would be a waste to put such beauty behind a helmet, obviously.
That is our show this week. It's been some great discussion. Thanks a lot for listening. Gonna be back next week. So don't forget to hit all those buttons like we talked about before. We'll see y'all soon, everybody.
Boy.
See ya.
What they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.